This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Joseph Cornell was a 20th century American artist best known for the evocative shadow boxes he assembled, boxes that contained and transformed everyday objects, text, and images. The boxes have been likened to dreams called lyrical and poetic. We'll talk this afternoon about Joseph Cornell with Linda Roscoe Hartigan. She has studied and written extensively on Joseph Cornell. Listeners, I invite you to join us as well. Your questions and comments are invited for Linda Roscoe Hartigan. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Linda Roscoe Hartigan is chief curator at the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, Massachusetts. She is the founding curator of the Smithsonian American Art Museum's Joseph Cornell Study Center. Hartigan is also the author of the catalog companion to the recent retrospective of Cornell's work, Joseph Cornell, Navigating the Imagination. The catalog of the same name is published by the Peabody Essex Museum and the Smithsonian American Art Museum in association with Yale University Press. Now, before we get Linda on the air with us this afternoon, I want to share something with you from the description of this book. Joseph Cornell, 1903 to 1972, was a self-taught yet highly sophisticated artist who is celebrated for his pioneering achievement in collage, assemblage, and film. Cornell's lyrical compositions combine found materials in ways that reflect a very personal exploration of art and culture and that represent his belief in art as an uplifting voyage into the imagination. For an online experience of Navigating the Imagination, by the way, you can point your browser to www.pem.org/Cornell. That's PEM, which stands for the Peabody Essex Museum. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Linda, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, good afternoon. I'm thrilled to be talking to you.
Oh, it is so wonderful to learn more about Joseph Cornell. Navigating the Imagination. This brings me to want to ask you, how did Cornell view imagination? How did he talk about it? How did he think about it?
Well, let's see here. This is the kind of question where I wish I could say, you know, I had actually talked to him about this over coffee, and
yeah,
he was just clear as a bell on that sort of thing. And unfortunately, I never had the chance to meet him in the course of doing my research all these years. But I think that he was genuinely fascinated by what our minds represent. And for him, I think the mind and the imagination really meant this combination of our, you know, our brain activity, what goes on in our heart in terms of emotion and process. You know, what is it that you physically do in order to express what you're thinking and feeling in combination? He had an extraordinary curiosity about how other people's minds and imaginations worked. So that frequently in his papers, you'll see all sorts of references to creative figures, you know, from dance, from theater, from music, from literature, from, you know, the realms of art, just because there were qualities about them that he found really helpful to him in terms of even understanding what his own creative process was. So in the end, I think he really did see the imagination as a voyage, you know, a river with many tributaries, and he frequently has been described as a solitary person, but I think he saw the imagination and how he might express his as a way of really connecting with people. So it's both this internal experience and as well as an external expression for him, and that's in many respects not all that uncommon from from how many artists actually view what they're doing. But I think he was just much more focused on the processes that, all of that entailed.
Yeah. You report in the book that among his metaphors for imagination was the echo chamber. Mm-hmm. That's interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, the when you think about echo, it's, of course, about reverberation and variation. You know, the echoes change depending on what they're bouncing off of. And, you know, in a literal sense, an echo changes because of a surface and the relationship with the air. But for him, the things that were echoing with each other were ideas and objects and images that he saw in different realms, because he read so much, he listened to music a great deal while he was working on his objects and collages. He went to film on a regular basis. He lived with film in the house, that sort of thing. So it's really, you know, I've sometimes imagined him visually for myself as someone who's standing at pond's end, throwing the stone in, and then there are all these concentric ripples that just really radiate out from, you know, a particular moment of inspiration. So you can have echo chamber, you can have concentric circles, rippling, that sort of thing. But whatever he was working with was really a pretty stocked inventory. There was a lot moving around and crunching together.
Yeah. He was very engaged. You know, while we think of him as solitary, private, shy, he was very engaged with the world.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I think that's one of the greatest disservices that any of us could do in terms of misunderstanding the difference between the value of your privacy, the value of solitary activity, and where that connects with the world. He had a tremendous range of things that he did in his life. He wasn't just an artist. He took care of an elderly mother and a brother with cerebral palsy for many, many years. He supported his family by a variety of basically odd jobs on and off over several decades. He collected all the materials that he worked with. So this was not somebody who was just stuck in a basement somewhere doing something as a true hermit. As you read at the beginning of the program, he really did see art as uplifting, but it wasn't just about uplifting him. I mean, yes, there was personal satisfaction involved in making his art, but it was really about how he could connect people to the joy to be derived from making art, or the ideas that art could spark for us, or how you can really travel, if you will, between the past and the present, or American and French culture, American and Italian culture, Asian cultures and European cultures, between music and literature, by virtue of those kinds of that openness to really making connections. So, you know, I just see his work being involved with an incredible sensitivity to the notion of connective tissue rather than separateness.
One of the ways you put it in Navigating the Imagination is to say, quote, he deliberately chose to make art as a life-affirming act of communication and educational outreach. Mm-hmm. When did that objective become clear to him?
I think, frankly, it was clear to him from the outset. For people who are not generally familiar with Cornell, because you also indicated at the beginning that he was self-taught, he did not go to art school. And this was someone who, in the 1920s in New York as a textile salesman, was busy filling in his days and evenings with going to the theater, the ballet, different kinds of musical performances, collecting books and photographs, reading a great deal, and that sort of thing. And when you go through his papers, it's clear that these kinds of daily encounters with culture, sometimes in very refined circumstances like an expensive theater or something as simple as a secondhand store in New York, there was this notion for him of uplift and excitement and joy. And I think because art gave that to him, he understood intuitively that that was something that he could give back to people through the making of art, and that's not necessarily even back in the 1920s and 30s how art was presented as a subject to be studied in art schools. I think also because of his conversion to Christian Science, which has a very expansive philosophy about a person's responsibility of connecting with the world and doing good, and because he came from a very religious family that had a high sense of moral responsibility towards other people, this outwardness, you know, what do you give to others in a selfless way, was really part and parcel of the package that Cornell was even as a young man.
When did he discover Christian Science? How did he discover it?
He converted to Christian Science around 1925, and a co-worker at the William Whitman Textile Company in New York was a Christian Science practitioner, and that means someone who would work actively with people to move them toward healing. Now, it doesn't mean that someone is simply a Christian Scientist. And because Cornell is a young man, suffered quite a bit, apparently, from stomach ailments and general anxiety, and he didn't really have much success, I guess, in dealing with it. Otherwise, this co-worker approached him and suggested that he learn more about Christian Science. So it was this very casual encounter with the religion. But I think underpinning that also was the fact that because his brother Robert had cerebral palsy and all sorts of other kinds of encounters with doctors and in some instances quacks, had really not led to an understanding of what Robert's problem was. Cornell himself moved on to how could he help his brother alleviate his pain. And, you know, religion is solace for many people in those kinds of circumstances. So Cornell converted his brother Robert and his other sister Elizabeth to Christian Science as a way of, you know, dealing in a family context with what was basically a difficult circumstance.
Yeah. Now, at the same time, he was interested in science. So isn't that a contradiction?
Well, there's science with an S and science with a little S and science mm-hmm. with a capital S. And that, and it's a distinction, actually, that while I'm not going to profess to be an expert in Christian science, when you read Mary Baker Eddy's writings, there's frequently this distinction between lowercase science and uppercase science, the uppercase science being, you know, the higher mind of Christian Science. But I think that in terms of his interest in science, it led him to things like being interested in astronomy, to physics, to, you know, the workings and the processes of the world. He loved flowers. I mean, so we have to take it out of the technical sense of science in terms of what he understood science to be. And then Mary Baker Eddy herself had this incredible mingling of understanding of things like metaphysics and natural history, and, you know, the natural history and natural science and what was metaphysical science was all kind of blended together in intriguing ways in the 19th century. And she took bits and pieces of that, you know, the whole notion of natural philosophy, for example, that combined science and religion and then separated after a point with the natural sciences being set aside. You know, there's you know, he just kind of filtered these things from different sources and came up, I think, in many respects with his own understanding of science as one way that the world operates, but he also looked at science as being a source of creativity.
Hmm. For listeners who are unfamiliar with Cornell's work, mm-hmm. maybe it would be useful if you could to give us some sense of it in terms of describing a piece, perhaps, maybe the work that's featured on the jacket.
And on the jacket, it's only shown in partial detail, but I would ask listeners to imagine the equivalent of a toy theater or a shadow box, both of which were traditions that inspired Cornell. So in terms of his box constructions, we are talking about something that is three-dimensional, that basically would either be horizontal or vertical in orientation. An average size would be, say, 18 inches high by 12 inches wide by 4 or 5 inches deep if it was a horizontal box, and then otherwise just turn those dimensions around and you'd get the sense of the vertical or the horizontal scale, but frequently they were made, their container sense was made with wood that he scavenged, and then he arranged in the interior of a box pieces of paper, different kinds of everyday objects, things like cutouts from maps and magazines, cork balls, clay pipes, cutouts from photographs, to really create this, it's like a scenario, if you will, but sometimes it's not clear to you why he's brought those elements together, and that's when an understanding of what he knew about different subjects like history and mathematics and ballet becomes important. But he also stained the exteriors of the boxes, as well as their backs. They're meant to be seen in the round. And essentially, they're these little compartments of ideas and images brought together. Does that help?
Yeah, that helps. I hope folks will go to the website, the PEM website, and engage with that site online, Navigating the Imagination. It's a beautifully done website.
No, we had fun doing it, and people really do enjoy it. It's there are elements of it that are interactive. So
yeah, and that's where I'm going next. Is that there's in many of these pieces so much playfulness at work? I think would that be fair to say?
Absolutely. He had a really great sense of humor, although there's some people who would describe him as kind of gray and serious and what have you. But you can see in his writing, and for people who knew him well, there was a very clear sense of humor that he operated with. And the playfulness in part comes from the fact that there are elements in the boxes that frequently move. You know, the balls frequently roll, or there are rings that are suspended on rods, and they move from left to right if you're handling the boxes. You can open lids and that sort of thing. So you're meant to have some kind of direct body relationship with the work, even though the boxes have a glass front to them, so you can't reach into them. And there was a point in time in the 30s when his work was described as being toys for adults. And it really wasn't a phrase that he appreciated much, mm-hmm. because he thought that denigrated the work. He knew he was making art. But there was this whole 19th century tradition of using toys for both children and adults as educational pastimes, as a way of making the delivery of knowledge and information and experience more palatable. Or more engaging, and he knew about that tradition, and I do think that that's also part of what he brought into the work, because also when I invited people to think of these things as miniature theaters, there were toy theaters in the Victorian era that he grew up in, and that was all about entertainment at home. So there's this domestic scale and an invitation to really engage with the work.
Mm-hmm. What should we know about Joseph Cornell's background, his family, and his childhood?
He was born in 1903 in Nyack, New York, which was at the time a well-to-do town on the Hudson River. He came from, indeed, as a result, a well-to-do family. His father commuted into New York working for a textile firm. His mother and his father were very culturally oriented and shared that with their children. So both parents sang and played musical instruments. His mother wrote film scenarios in sort of an amateur basis. They took their children to the early movies in the teens and the 20s. They took them into New York City to experience various things. So he was in a family context that encouraged exploration of the world around you. They also spent a fair number of vacations in New England in very rustic circumstances. It's where he really learned to love the outdoors and the flora and fauna. And in the midst of that, which I suppose could sound fairly idyllic, was the notion of a very tightly knit family unit. Cornell had two younger sisters, and then the youngest child was Robert, and he was the one who suffered from cerebral palsy. In a very heightened sense, I guess it would say, because he really was physically crippled, although not mentally in any way. And so the notion of this family having all of these opportunities but also needing to deal with a child who had a lot of challenges was something that really drove the family life. And that's why what religion was very important to the family as a source of support.
Hmm. And when did his father die?
Cornell was about 14 years old when his father died in 1917, and it was right before he was sent to the Phillips Academy in Andover, Massachusetts, for his private high school education. And I think Cornell spent a fair amount of his adult life mourning for his father. It was one of these abruptly ended relationships, and I think it really set Cornell back at a certain point. He was a very shy young man, so to be sent off to school away from a family that just had a father taken away from it, not doing well in school, I think he was one of these people who was inherently very bright and inquisitive but did not do well in formal, structured educational circumstances. And then because he didn't really qualify to go on to college, and his family's fortunes diminished after his dad died, when Cornell came back to the family in 1921, he really had to take on the responsibility of earning the principal funds for the family to live on. And that was a lot of responsibility for someone who really was not prepared to do that.
Yeah. What did he think of the working world? What kind of jobs did he do at that point?
Well, his first job was as a door-to-door textile salesman for a company owned by a family friend. So he had a beat, if you will, on the Lower East Side, up and down Fourth Avenue and into the wholesale textile neighborhood. And you know, he was obviously to peddle the samples for the company, and apparently he really didn't enjoy doing that at all. He would do things, apparently, like slip into the bookstores and look at the books, and somehow the textile samples would get left behind, and he'd come home instead with the books that he'd bought or the photographs and that sort of thing. It was a source of anxiety for him. It really was one of the principal reasons why he developed such stomach cramps and anxiety that led to the conversion to Christian Science as a way of dealing with it. So I think he very much was put upon by the notion of having to be in this adult world that he wasn't really prepared for. And there's some really telling passages in his papers where he talks about really the nightmare alley of Lower Broadway in the 20s, and that really was a reference to the streets he was supposed to be going up and down and trying to sell his wares.
Yeah. So he's nipping into the bookstores, and he's doing a lot of reading. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting. In the book, you've included a dual bibliography. The first is a sampling of resources that document and discuss his work. And then the second is a sampling from the 4,000 items in his library. Would you give us a sense of the range of his interests? At the end of his life, he's got this huge library.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really quite something, and it was, I mean, I love books, so being in the candy store, because first the range of topics, and then just some insights about some other things related to these books, because he just read across a wide terrain of subjects. So when I had to, because he had no system for arranging the books in his house, when the books came to the Cornell Study Center in Washington, I had to think about, okay, how would I want people to be able to come into this center and understand what types of books he was involved with or subjects. So I organized them by subject. So, you'd have two boxes of books related to dance and ballet, more boxes of books associated with poetry, American, European, Asian, all sorts of books and publications related to art, music, dance, mathematics, physics, science, history, books on Esperanto, elementary French, and that sort of thing, because he did save a lot of his textbooks even from the Phillips Academy. But I think my favorite book, for no particular reason except that I think it really stood out in terms of being kind of the oddball. He had a paperback version of Sheila Graham's Confessions, Sheila Graham being a Hollywood gossip columnist, very famous in the 50s and the 60s. And then he would have absolutely rare, even priceless books from the late 18th century, printed in Russian or German or Latin. And even though he couldn't read those languages, he was just enamored of even the book as an object. And in the midst of owning all of these books, when you really look at a lot of his work, you see a tremendous amount of paper. And then you realize that the paper came from books. So on the one hand, he was a true bibliophile, somebody who collected books for the sake of owning books and learning from them and enjoying them. And then he also used them as raw material, because I'd come across books that had all their guts cut out of them, and I'd realize, oh, well, those papers went into that box, or that's what he put on the back of a box, or once he took the guts outside out of a box, he'd put a little wooden framework inside of it and put objects in the framework and close the book, and it would be like a secret compartment book. So there was a real mixed metaphor there in terms of his romance with books.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Today on the program, we're talking about Joseph Cornell, the 20th century American artist, probably best known for the evocative shadow boxes he assembled. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and our guest this afternoon, Linda Roscoe Hartigan. She is chief curator at the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, Massachusetts. She's also the author of the catalog companion to the recent retrospective of Cornell's work, Joseph Cornell, Navigating the Imagination. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Who were the artists that influenced him? What role did the Surrealists play in his evolution?
Well, the Surrealists were one in a cast of thousands. And I say that simply because oftentimes you will read about Cornell's work and people assert, for example, that he was influenced to become an artist or to make collages as an artist by the Surrealist painter and collagist Max Ernst in the early 1930s. And Cornell definitely saw Ernst's collages, but he had also before that seen a lot of Victorian collage, you know, collaged bottles, collaged decals and valentines and cards and that sort of thing. So Cornell had this interesting way of taking things out of popular culture as well as fine art traditions. And he often said that he actually wasn't influenced by any particular artist, and yet I asserted the cast of thousands, because he went to Alfred Stieglitz's galleries in the 1920s and looked at a lot of photography and really learned a lot about framing images. He enjoyed medieval art, Japanese and Chinese art for their simplicity and refinement as early as the 1920s. I think with the Surrealists, when he went to Julian Levy's gallery in New York in 1931 and throughout the 1930s, this was a gallery and a dealer who really championed Surrealism as this source of making art that looked at reality in a different way. And because those artists frequently also used found objects and combined them in some genuinely eccentric or unexpected ways, and Cornell was already doing that on his own, I think Cornell walked into that gallery and found kindred spirits as opposed to people who influenced him to make what he made. And that to me is a very important distinction.
Let's take a call now. A listener in Champaign would like to talk with you. Line one, go ahead. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Fine, how are you?
Good, thank you. I've got a couple questions.
Good.
First one is, I understand that Cornell had a retrospective at your museum that went and then went to San Francisco.
Yeah, it opened at the show Joseph Cornell Navigating the Imagination opened at the Smithsonian American Art Museum, where I used to work. in November of 2006, and then it came to the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, Massachusetts, where I work now, and then it went on to the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, and it closed there on January 6th, 2008.
Do you know if it has any plans for that to go to Chicago?
No, it's not going to Chicago. There were a number of works from Chicago collections included in the exhibition, but the show's not going to Chicago, and I understand why you're asking, because you live nearby.
Yeah. Or do you know if it's going to go anywhere else, or is it just going to kind of, that's it for the...
No, it's the show's closed, and all of the works have actually been returned to the owners now.
Okay. Then my other question is, my understanding is that some of the boxes have kinetic aspects to them, and I was wondering, have any ever been displayed so that the components can move?
Well, I tried to do that actually in different ways in the installation. I mean, once something is in a museum environment, as much as Cornell loved to have people handle his works and play with them, once they're in the museum environment, we have to protect them. So what I did in certain instances was to choose to tell people about what moved or what performed in a box through what I wrote in a label that would accompany the work. In other instances, we put alternate views of a box with the box itself to show what it looked like if a portion of it had moved or changed. We also have included a slideshow of works that had been taken from video of works in motion so that people could see the balls and various parts move in the works. There is a DVD called The Magical Worlds of Joseph Cornell, and that has a tremendous amount of footage that really helps you get inside the works to see how different parts actually operate and what the materials are like. So I'd encourage you to look for that if you're interested.
That's interesting. Did any of them actually have mechanical components, or was it more just from a person handling the box that would make sense?
Now, some of the boxes, there are probably about 12 that had music boxes in them mm-hmm. as actual mechanical parts. I mean, one of them plays Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, for example, and you could crank the music box and hear the tune. There are other boxes that have strings that you can pull so that you make figures move and that sort of thing. But in terms of actual apparatus, the music boxes come closest, I think, to what you're asking about.
Mm-hmm. I've got one more question
sure.
for you. Joseph Cornell's been gone for about 30 years or so. Why do you think his work is still so compelling to people?
In part, I think, because he really saw people as his audience, mm-hmm. I think there is a type of artist who can make the work with very much the art world conversation on their mind, you know, the work's being made within a much more circumscribed realm of the concept of audience. Cornell really wanted to reach the everyday person on the street, which is slightly ironic because if you don't know what some of the references in the works are about, that could seem to be a little bit off-putting. But the other element that I'm quite sure is at work here is that his notion of connectivity and networking and associations we've now caught up with because we ourselves now are so attuned to creating our own network of associations through, you know, navigating the web. He, in some respects, can be described as sort of a mega computer in terms of all the various parts that he brought together through his imagination. And I think that particularly young people respond to his work because they sense that in it.
Well, thank you very much. I guess I would just encourage people to look at the collection in Chicago. I assume when those boxes are back, it'll be all together, and they're wonderful.
Right, and you're referring to the Art Institute of Chicago.
Right, the Art Institute. Thank you. so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. Yeah, I suspect that most people, upon seeing his work or photographs of it, are immediately intrigued and drawn to them. What was your introduction to the work of Joseph Cornell?
Well, at one point I went to the Metropolitan Museum in New York and saw a show in 1970 called New York Painting and Sculpture, 1940 to 1970. And there was one room or gallery in that show that was devoted to Cornell's work. So, you know, I was an art history major at the time in college, and that was my first direct experience of the work. And his work at that point in time was certainly nothing that was included in, like, general surveys of art history. But when I went to the Smithsonian American Art Museum in 1973 as an intern in graduate school, I happened to intern with a man who had known Cornell well, had already curated exhibitions of his work, and organized a small memorial exhibition of Cornell's work 1 year after Cornell had passed away. And I worked on that exhibition with the curator, Walter Hopps. So that was my real hardcore introduction, and things kind of evolved from there.
What did Walter Hopps have to say about what kind of a man Joseph Cornell was and what their friendship was like?
Walter, as a curator, was the type of person who really engaged very quickly with how an artist thought about things. I mean, in many respects, I've often thought about Walter himself as, you know, curator as artist in many respects. Hmm. But he understood Cornell to be very, very complex and very, very innovative, and someone who, for all of his inquisitiveness about the world, really didn't want to say too much about the whys and wherefores of his work. So Walter could pepper any individual with lots of questions, and yet I think understood that if he was quiet in the presence of Cornell in the cellar workroom, in other rooms in the house, talking with him at length on the phone, even if that meant like long silences on the phone that Cornell was famous for, that, you know, he could osmose rather than extract information and understanding from Cornell, because in wanting to reach out to people, I think Cornell wanted people to interpret the works for what they could get from them, and yet the minute someone really kind of didn't get the work, then Cornell thought, well, you know, why are they thinking that? I mean, he had some mixed messages for himself in terms of what he hoped to accomplish with people looking at the work. And, you know, questions about influence or why did you make the first work or what does this work mean would tend to set him off from conversations that I've had with any number of people who knew Cornell. Instead, he wanted to find out how your mind worked, but that it didn't always have to be about his work. So it was a complex circumstance, and I know that Walter thought of him both fondly and with incredible respect for him as an artist. Mm. And it's, you know, and the show and the book actually are dedicated in part to Walter, because he went on to become my mentor.
Mm. Joseph Cornell, when did he begin thinking of himself, and this is a question you ask at the very outset of Navigating the Imagination, when does an artist become an artist? When did he begin seeing himself as an artist?
In any sort of official, comfortable, yes, this is what I'm going to be doing mm-hmm. for the rest of my life sense, I would really say that it was around 1940 or 1941, and as you know, that's where I actually end the essay. in the book, because no one's really written about the 20s or the 30s, the whole formative period for Cornell, and that's what I focused on in one of the essays in the book. But there came a point where he understood that he really was not going to be the kind of everyday person who was going to go to a job 9 to 5. This simply did not suit his temperament. And he had the drive to create. And in 1941, he really made a studio out of the basement in the house that he shared with his mother and his brother. And he really had a discussion with his mother about becoming an artist and really that being the principal path rather than the everyday jobs, because because he, you know, he was torn between this sense of responsibility to a family and a responsibility to himself in order to grow and become the person that he needed to become. And by that time, in the in 1941, he'd already had exhibitions in museums and in galleries. People had started to buy his work, had started writing about his work. So within a very quick or short period of time, he had the taste of success that a lot of artists wait much longer to get in their lives. So he had the confidence building of actually, you know, having that public receptivity. And but that, plus the determination that he really had to do this, was when he reached his public moment of, I am an artist, and I'm going to continue to be an artist.
Mm. Back to the idea of his wish, his desire to make connections, to reach out. He was fascinated by people, famous and not famous. Mm-hmm. He also created pieces for celebrities, and as you mentioned earlier, he, in his library, had one of the things that you found was a book by a gossip columnist. Mm-hmm. What did he think of celebrity, and what kind of relationships did he have with celebrities? I read somewhere that a friend of his was Tony Curtis.
Mm-hmm. I think Cornell, frankly, would be absolutely appalled by what we describe as celebrity today. And he was in awe of people who danced, sang, performed music, acted. He really saw them as extraordinarily creative people. He was very concerned about how fleeting the achievement of performers and artists can be seen by other people. There's some very poignant passages in his paper about 19th century ballerinas who in their lifetime excited so many people through their performances, and then the minute that they walk off the stage, they're forgotten, or they reach the end of their prime as a dancer and they're forgotten, or certain kinds of styles fall out of fashion, things are forgotten. So he had this interesting combination, I think, of being something of a stage door Johnny. You know, he'd stand in the wings of some of the ballet performances in New York as he met ballerinas and watched them from the wings. He'd collect mementos from their costumes and then put those elements into his artworks. He really, I think, developed crushes on particular actresses from afar and up close as he met them in the theatrical circles that he traveled in. So there was this combination of tremendous respect for what their creativity represented, and then in relation to women as actresses and ballerinas and what have you, there really was this admiration from afar, you know, basically elevating someone to the point of heroine, rather than, you know, very idealized, in other words, as opposed to a pragmatic kind of emotional relationship.
Yeah. The pieces that are in the book Navigating the Imagination come to mind. Carmen Miranda, that wonderful construction titled Garbo, the piece that was done featuring Lauren Bacall.
My favorite box.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That is wonderful. Speaking of Lauren Bacall that and Garbo, that gets us to film. And what would you like to say? He was also this avant-garde filmmaker. Tell us maybe just a little bit about the film Rose Hobart, and then we'll have to wrap up.
Okay, that's fine. I think the most intriguing thing to me about Cornell as a filmmaker is that he never learned how to use a camera. So someone would say, okay, then how do you become a filmmaker? that's magic. And just as Cornell cut and pieced objects together or pieces of paper together to create his collages, he collected old films, and he literally would cut up the films in the 1930s and splice them together and rearrange parts from different films, and then that's how he would create a film that could be projected. In the 1950s, he worked with other avant-garde filmmakers, and he would take them out onto the streets of New York and basically direct them, you know, take a picture of those pigeons flying in the sky around the New York Public Library, or that little girl running around the fountain, or or those store windows, he'd take their footage back into his studio and, with their permission, cut that footage up and recombine it and create films from that. And so, you know, it was just a very different approach to the process, and it turned out that it was extraordinarily influential on filmmakers of his time. But he adored film as a medium.
What an interesting man. There we have to leave it. I want to thank you, Linda, very much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, I've really enjoyed the conversation, and I hope the listeners have learned something more about the artist.
Thank you very much. Linda Roscoe Hartigan is chief curator at the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, Massachusetts. She is also the author of the catalog companion to the recent retrospective of Cornell's work, Joseph Cornell, Navigating the Imagination. The catalog is of the same name, Joseph Cornell, Navigating the Imagination. It is published by the Peabody Essex Museum and the Smithsonian American Art Museum in association with Yale University Press. And for an online experience of Navigating the Imagination, you can point your browser to www.pem.org/Cornell. And we'll have a link to that website at our website, will.illinois.edu.